Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's Planned Giving Conference Call on Wills and Living Trusts, brought to you by the Dominican Foundation and the Rosary Shrine of St. Jude. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you'll have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touchtone phone. Please note, this call will be recorded. It is now my pleasure to introduce the hosts of today's program, Ms. Diana Kilargian and Mr. Jonathan Gudina. Diana is the director of the Office of Planned Giving for the Dominican Foundation and the Rosary Shrine of St. Jude. She has served the Dominican friars in many capacities during the past 10 years, and along with directing Planned Giving, Diana is a relationship manager working closely with donors to the foundation and the shrine. Diana is the person to call for all your questions on Planned Giving and is pleased to assist you to establish charitable gift annuities, bequests, or other planned gifts in reaching your charitable goals. Jonathan Gudina is an attorney, licensed in New York and New Jersey since 1995, who specializes in general estate and tax planning and estate litigation. He has been dedicated to working with nonprofit institutions and assisting their supporters in the creation of charitable estate plans since 1998. Jonathan founded Planned Giving Advisors, LLC in 2011 and is a frequent public speaker on areas of estate and tax planning, as well as charitable giving vehicles. Jonathan has been advising the Dominican Foundation and Rosary Shrine for the past 2 years to help supporters realize their charitable intentions with their estate plans or other giving options. I am delighted to now turn today's program over to Diana and Jonathan. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you.
We're delighted to be here this morning. I want to say good morning and welcome to our guests. Thank you for joining us. And also welcome to Jonathan. Jonathan, thank you for joining me here at the Foundation and Rosary Shrine offices this morning. We are delighted to be able to offer this opportunity to have a conversation about these important topics of wills, why we need a will, and also the option of a living trust. So, and we'll have an opportunity for question and answer at the end, and you know, please feel free to ask any questions you have about these topics. We are hoping to shed some light for you this morning. So to get the conversational ball rolling here, Jonathan, why don't I start with asking, why do I need a will? Do I need a will, and if so, why?
Well, I mean, obviously, not everybody has a will. In fact, less than 50% of Americans pass away without a will. That being said, it is an extremely important document. Besides deciding what would happen to minor children, meaning who would be the guardian, and that's for younger families, that is the most important reason to have a will, to make sure that should something happen to both parents, or if there's only one parent involved, who would be the guardian for those children. But there are many other reasons to have a will, as we'll talk about. I would think that the most important reason is just to create a legacy for your family. When there's no will, what happens is the state steps in with the law. There is a law that will apply to you if you do not have a will. It's the state called the estate and testate laws. Essentially, the state, whatever state you live in, determine what would happen to you should you pass away without a will. And like I said, half of America or more actually do not do their wills. It can be a very big mistake because, depending on the state you live in, it can be quite arbitrary, and what I call unintended results could happen.
Okay, so what would be some of those unintended results? What happens, if you could explain what happens when a person passes away without a will, and what some of those unintended results are?
Well, firstly, you're already create one of the reasons people don't think about it, they don't want to do a will, they want to try to pass everything without a will, because again, you could pass assets, you could assign accounts, account designations, beneficiary designations. They're not governed by your will.
Like a life insurance?
Yeah, life insurance would usually be outside of a will. But if you think you're sort of avoiding probate, and that was really the 1960s, somebody wrote a book that was a big hit seller. You know, probate is such a terrible thing. But the reality is that even if you don't have a will, there's going to be a probate. You're going to cause your family or other loved ones to have to go to court to get appointed someone, to get appointed as the administrator of the estate, and you're already creating more and more legal hassles. So having a will initially just sets on who will be the executor, who will be managing your estate, and that itself is very important, because otherwise you might even have family fights over that. And then the other unintended result is the law is applied as written, meaning it's, let's say the law, I think New York State, it says, you know, somebody dies without a will, a surviving spouse, half, and children divide everything else equally. Well, there may be, that may not have been what you intended, let's put it that way. And, could, you know, for example, in a second marriage where you want to make sure that the bulk of your estate is saved for the children of the first marriage, but yet you want to establish something for your current spouse, a standard will would probably not accomplish that. And then the other example would be is that if there are no children around, the courts will look for, they'll do a genealogy research on your family to find out who is next in line, and that might be not who you would have wanted your assets to go to. And I've been in cases where, you know, they'll track down people in Europe and say, you know, you're entitled to this estate, yet while, you know, local, everybody who knew these people knew the person who passed away, they're cut out of it, and there's really no way around it. So,
okay, thank you. If we could just go back for a minute, you mentioned the probate process. And sounds like what you said is that there's probate process takes place no matter what.
Well, I'll take that back. If when someone passes away, if there are assets in that person's name that need to be changed, legal title, for example, a house, could even be a car, bank accounts, stock certificates, brokerage accounts, you have to get a court document that enables you, if you're the point executor or administrator of the estate, you need the court to give you authority to go to those, go to each brokerage account and say, okay, you know, here is, I'm the executor, I'm changing the title of this account or liquidating it. So, because obviously the person whose name is in is passed away. So you need a legal process. So anybody who passes away with anything in their names, for the most part, will need some sort of probate. There are times when a probate is very limited. For example, there's only, I have one estate that I'm the attorney for the probate, and all there was a house, which it hasn't even sold yet, and they immediately hired me, so because they had a buyer ready, so they couldn't just sell the house. And the house was in the name of somebody who had passed away, so you need that if there's any assets that need to be turned over, where there's a change in title.
Okay. What about, let's say a person has a will, how often does one change a will? Is it necessary ever to change a will? What are the kinds of, you know, reasons that one would change their will?
Well, it's a good idea to review your wills and all the related documents, which hopefully we'll touch upon, but, you know, I'll just mention, obviously there's what's called a power of attorney. That's a document that allows somebody to handle your finances if you're not able to, disabled or unable for physical reasons. You want to review these documents regularly. Also, a living will or health care directive. Again, that's something that gives somebody the power to make decisions for you, medical decisions, life or death medical decisions, and there may be religious reasons particularly that you want to see followed. So again, you want these documents, and you want to review them. Sometimes, you know, for the will in particular, you want to review, do all your you know, bequests make sense at this point? Sometimes people, other relatives you've decided to include in your plans have passed away. What happens to those funds? They get put into let's say the residuary of your estate. So sometimes your things have changed, circumstances have changed, and therefore your will really should be updated. I will say that I've seen both cases where people's wills were written 20 or 30 years prior, and I would tend to say I've seen those wills, very old wills, I would tend to say that most of them probably did not reflect the wishes of the individual at the time of their passing. And quite often I represent not charitable institutions, and I would see all the wills that come through. I've seen thousands of wills coming through when I represent charities, and I could say that the old, the one, those cases, many times I could tell right away that and the person had no involvement with that charity for many years and no connection.
And they had just failed to update their will.
Yeah, they failed to update it. And there are many reasons to update your will besides changing of your own personal circumstances. Maybe your wishes have changed. Maybe you're more involved with one charitable institution and you want to do a charitable bequest and you want to change it. That's something that people will revisit. And sometimes things like the state you live in, if you change states, I recommend getting a will in the new state.
Different laws.
There are different laws, and there's just what you're trying to avoid is creating complexities after you're gone. Obviously you're not here to actually witness it, but as an attorney in this area, I see unfortunately many times if the family didn't anticipate things and properly, it creates a whole series of problems. And the example of the will not being updated, if the will that you have is difficult to probate, I mean, because the probate court has to accept that will as your last will and testament, if that becomes a problem, then you're creating delays in the administration of your estate, and or if the will fails to be accepted by the court in the jurisdiction that you live in at the time you pass away, then you're back to what the state says. You know, I call it arbitrary and capricious state laws. Again, you'd have to look into what your state laws are, but I would, even if you look at what your state law is in terms of how they would handle your estate if you pass away without a will, I would say you would always want to still do your own will.
Okay. So, Jonathan, you mentioned that a person's wishes may change over time. Certainly, you know, family relations may change, all that kind of thing, but you also mentioned that a person may have a greater dedication to one charity or another, and if they don't have a will or if they do not update their will, then it sounds like there would be a real missed opportunity there for them to set forth their legacy even after they're gone, in terms of how, you know, their support for this, you know, a particular charity.
Yeah, I think it's
that kind of thing.
Yeah, I've seen this. I think it's very important to think about your own legacy when you're doing your planning, and that's one of the reasons why to revisit your wills also, because it's not just about sending cash gifts to different individuals, but you can really accomplish something. And I think we'll get to it, but one of the goals of just general planning and sitting down and creating a nice list of everything you have and organizing it. Number one, you're setting up your heirs and your executor. You're organizing things for them so that they're not scrambling. Things do get lost.
Right.
I mean, I have a great aunt who's investment account of $5,000 to $10,000. Still sitting 25 years later, and I haven't figured out how to release it.
Right.
But on top of that, you start realizing how much you really might have. People quite often don't realize that, and if you start adding up, you own a house, and maybe it's paid off, and maybe the neighborhood is value has gone up, maybe some old stock investments, maybe some retirement funds, but I think a lot of people don't realize how much they may actually have in their potential estates. If they had realized, they might think differently in terms of their legacy, and for example, they might want to. You may have enough funds to create a perpetual scholarship fund at an institution that you care about. For this institution, for example.
Right.
So you may feel that you have limited resources, but you might have significant assets, and you have to put it all in one paper and add it all up and realize, wow, there's something here, and maybe there's some legacy I can think about beyond just gifts to family and friends.
Right. So that underscores the importance of planning, as you said. So Jonathan, maybe you could take us through, what are some important things to think about in this whole planning process. We understand the importance of having a will, why we need a will, what are some things we need to be thinking about. In particular, let's say, what would be some meaningful goals to consider?
Yeah, so this is really important. I already mentioned about getting organized. It's getting organized for yourself,
right,
helping you in your own retirement planning, helping you understand what your resources are that you'll need to live off of, hopefully in good shape for the rest of your life, but that's the point is you may actually need it as you get older,
right.
For your care. Understanding your full financial picture helps you think about your legacy beyond that. You could really start thinking about something bigger in your estate plans, usually with a charitable intent. But I think the other aspect of getting organized, which I've seen, it's very, very important. And we talked about the will. The will covers things that are titled in your name.
Mm-hmm.
But I did, and we touched a little bit on beneficiary designation.
Right.
So beneficiary designations applies to your IRA accounts,
mm-hmm.
applies to your retirement accounts, depends on what type of where you worked. Quite often, the older style retirement plans that used to be out there, if you work for the government, for example, or for a school system, your heirs may be entitled to a lump sum or continue payments.
Okay.
Again, that's not governed by the will. That's governed by the beneficiary designation form or your life insurance policies. You have to also, when you do your organizing things, not just the potential values and where things are and where the documents can be found, but you really want to revisit those beneficiary designations. I'll tell you one short story of an estate that I'm involved in, and I'm almost embarrassed to say, a family friend of mine, some people I've known for over 25 years, 8 daughters. I was in law school. They were a local family that I was friendly with, and they asked me at a certain point to help their father draft his will, and we understood that, you know, his goal was that every child would get an equal amount.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want to show any favoritism.
Mm-hmm.
He did want to set aside some assets for one of his daughters is developmentally disabled. And so we set up a special part of the assets so that it could be held in a separate place, in a separate little supplemental needs trust,
okay.
a special trust for that daughter. But during the conversations, and I can replay in my mind because I feel a little bad about this,
mm-hmm.
as we're discussing it, we in the discussion, everything is pretty simple will.
Right.
They mentioned, well, what was the retirement account? Oh, yeah, you know, the third daughter.
Mm-hmm.
She's on this one. The first one's on this. And I should have told them on that spot right
mm-hmm.
now. I should have said, we need to know exactly who is set to receive what, because
okay.
after he passed away and the short mourning period was finished, unfortunately the families and the girls and the sisters were all in a terrible fight because he left one of them basically he didn't have very much left in his name,
okay.
and he had a house and they're selling the house, but
his prime
cash bequest that would go to his family
mm-hmm.
was tied up in a retirement account,
right.
the retirement plan, and the lump sum went to one of the daughters, and she's not giving it. And so the family, and then you know the whole.
Right.
I feel terrible about it. So
right.
I really learned my lesson is that, you really have to. That is a very important part of planning. Again,
okay.
you have to have a will, but you also have to know what the will doesn't cover.
Right.
And you have to make sure that makes sense, because you can do the best will in the world, the most well thought out. You can review it every couple of years, but all these other assets pass outside of the will.
Right.
And create.
So would it be a good idea then, Jonathan, to have a professional estate planner and a financial planner? How do I determine if that's necessary for me?
I mean, I think any time you can get help, assistance in this area is very good.
Mm-hmm.
There is the financial planning, which is somebody who can help you in terms of your financial goals and trying to help you ensure that you have the right cash flow,
right.
income flow in your later years. And then there's the lawyer who helps with the actual estate planning. And some financial planners try to dabble in estate
mm-hmm.
planning, and they can be helpful, but I would try to balance it with an attorney. Attorneys are generally, you can, assuming you like your attorney, you trust him or her, I would defer to the attorney, and not that I'm so biased for attorneys, but attorneys generally have their prime mission is your interest in making sure that things are handled properly for you. Sometimes the financial planners give you great investment options, but they don't always make sense in the big picture, and particularly for your family. And again, this is we want to try to anticipate a little bit what will happen after we're not here and make sure that it's as smooth as possible.
So would it be necessary to have a financial power of attorney? And is that the same thing, or how does that differ from a durable power of attorney?
Yeah, that is a that is a durable power of attorney. That's, again, one of the documents we always talk about. So you, number one document, you've got to have a will.
Right.
Number two, a durable power of attorney. There might be different names for it in the state you live in, but it's a finance for financial purposes. So the document itself is a simple form. Mm-hmm. It depends on the state you live in. You really want to. This is a good idea to use an attorney also, because it may be very, you may, somebody who you've appointed to stand in your stead if something, if you're not able to handle your finances, they're going to have to take that document and go to the bank and say, okay, I'm appointed as the power of attorney. I'm now, the contingency has happened, meaning in the document itself, it says, should I be unable to make financial decisions for myself for XYZ, ABC reasons,
right.
Mr. Smith is now appointed. And that document works, and there, I've been involved in large financial transactions, selling of homes, things like that, where we relied upon a power of attorney. That's also, but that's a good warning to you, is to think clearly who you're going to choose for that role. That's a very important role, because they literally have the power to buy and sell and transact on your behalf.
Would that person be the same as your executor?
That's a good question. It could be, and not necessarily.
Okay.
That's a good question. I'm glad you asked that question. The executor is a very important person, and that's one of the reasons why you want to have a will,
because
you can choose your executor. If you don't choose your executor, the court will choose one for you, and your executor, you're really trusting a lot with that person in terms of executing your final wishes and doing it in a manner that is makes a lot of sense, and distributing it to the beneficiaries in a timely fashion and handling it's a paperwork job. So it may or may not be the same person. Does, to me, sounds like that's a typical similar person, somebody who you trust. You trust with finances, and that they'll do their best to follow your wishes, and you're entrusting them. So that is a very important document, and again, that's another reason. As you go to your attorney, there are different opinions on how often you need to go back to your will and other documents, but you will review your will.
Right.
And just make sure things are in order. And you review those power of attorney documents. And usually when I'm doing them for clients, and I usually work with younger couples because, you know, that I'm in my late 40s, and that's who I'm usually doing these planning documents for, usually they're appointing each other as power of attorney just in case. But over time, things change, and they may not be married anymore for various reasons.
Right.
And so you really want to double-check that document also. That will be a good document to revisit.
So what, is there a sort of good, I know some things that would prompt one to check their documents and their will and so forth, but is there a certain kind of rhythm as well, like, oh, you should check it at least once a year, or?
I would say every couple of years, maybe 3 to 5 years. I wouldn't let too many years go by without checking it, and I think the challenge is that it does cost money to go to your attorneys. I'm a fool, because this is not my prime business is not writing wills for people. Once I do their wills and paperwork, I don't recharge them ever again. But don't call me. I'm only New York, New Jersey. But I think, you know, people hesitate to go back to their attorneys. I think doing wills and these paperwork is usually, it's not a big money maker for the attorneys. They're really doing it as a service. Let's say the attorney's like the family attorney, hopefully.
Right.
And so I think that you should feel comfortable going back to your attorneys every couple of years. And I think there's a point this relates to another point that I want to ask a question.
Yeah.
I want to make sure we don't.
You want me to answer it, or are you going to answer your?
I'm going to answer the question. Is that I get this question quite often. I don't want to forget. You know, where do I put these
documents?
Right.
That was going to be my next question.
Okay, fine. So.
See, should I ask?
Yeah. Ask.
Okay,
the question.
So Jonathan. What are all the documents we should have in place, and what is a good place to keep them? Do we keep them with our attorney, or you know, in a safe place in the home, or do we give it to the executor to hang on to? What would you say to that?
Yeah, so this is what we call a bombshell question. This is, and not every attorney agrees on the answer.
Okay.
Let's just talk about the will first and then the other documents,
mm-hmm.
because there's some differences there. The will needs to be, somebody needs to find that will, the original copy, after you've passed away. And this is just a warning to everybody, if the will is not found, or if whoever finds it looks at it and says, boy, this is not so, I'll use the example of the great niece is the next in line to inherit your estate
mm-hmm.
should something happen to you. And the great niece is the one cleaning up the apartment.
Mm-hmm.
I had this once where a friend of my wife's was an older woman had passed away. My wife just, she used to call her every Friday just to wish her a good,
mm-hmm.
you know, to see how she's doing.
Right.
And after she had passed away, my wife just decided to call. I don't know why. She just called. And the great niece was there cleaning up.
Okay.
And I always wondered, because I did take a look at the will. I did go look at the will later on. Just we were wondering. I always wondered if she showed up there cleaning up the apartment, found multiple wills.
Okay. Showed, right.
And the truth is, I'm saying this because I don't have proof of this, but this is generally well known that whoever is taking care of your things after you've passed away may come upon your will, may decide to tear it up and throw it away. You know, and this is something to think about. Who's going to hold on to the will? Where is it going to be? It's a good idea to let people know if you have an executor, somebody who you're entrusted, could be a child, it could be a friend. They should know that this is a role you like them to play at some point when it may be necessary. And they should know where the document is. You may not want to give them the document. Again, the original is the only thing that really counts for the most part, for a will.
When
so,
you say original, do you mean like their first one?
I'm sorry, the actual signed will.
Right, the latest.
Now, the latest will. Now, every will says, this is my last will. All
right.
Previous wills are no good. But if you don't tear up the previous wills, then the one that given to the court for probate, that's the only one that will count.
Right.
So, number one, you want to tear up old wills. Number two, if you trust your attorney and the attorney you is hopefully, and again, a good reason to revisit this is the attorney's law office is available. Many attorneys will offer to hold the original. They'll
mm-hmm.
give you a copy stamped that says the original is
right.
in my vault.
Okay.
Most states require lawyers who hold these documents to have a fireproof type storage.
Mm-hmm.
So one option is particularly for your will, not necessarily for other documents, but for your will, one option is to have the actual original document with your attorney. Another option, I'll just mention this, and I guess this is something you'd have to research. Some states allow a individual to actually file a will with the county probate court.
Okay.
Us lawyers don't love this too much because you might do a will after that. It
right.
might create some confusion, but that's a possibility. Most lawyers would rather see the will left with them if they're going to have a law firm that's still in existence. The problem I have is that law firms, eventually lawyers also pass away or
right.
they also retire, and I've had to track down, particularly large law firms in New York City,
mm-hmm.
I've had to track down multiple, go from old law firm, you know, one big one.
Like
yeah, I have had to do searches there. But if that's a possibility. Now, the other, what about in your safety deposit box? So,
mm-hmm.
the caveat with the safety deposit box is again, this document, the will in particular, will your chosen executor will actually need that document to be able to submit it to the probate court. You don't have to do it right away, but within a reasonable amount of time, you'll want them to probate, you know, submit it for probate. We don't want to see that document in particular get sealed in a safety deposit box because once the bank finds out an individual has passed away, a lot of states actually will seal it, and they need a court order to get into that.
Right.
So then your executor or somebody will have to get a court order in advance of it's probating your will, creating conflicts there. Some states are more lenient on this. I think one idea would be is that if your chosen executor, let's say it's a child or somebody you really trust, maybe let them have access to your safety deposit box.
Mm-hmm.
So the two people are on the safety deposit box, and they know should something happen to me, you have the key, you can go to the safety deposit box and
right.
take out everything at that point. The other, what about in your house? So in your house, you may want to have a little lockbox, fireproof lockbox, and that maybe in your lockbox with important documents, that's where, if you're organized, you may want to keep various account information and stuff. So certain things you may want in that safety deposit box, a deed to the house,
right.
things like that. Other documents may be in your house with instructions where things are. That would be a really nice thing for people to do for your family, for your people, you know, to help get them going, to know where everything is. But again, that's usually somewhere in your in your house. And then, of course, we mentioned so power of attorney.
Right.
So the power of the actual document is only doesn't mean anything unless the individual is in his hands.
Okay.
Because you actually have to have the document with them. So you may have to make arrangements, make sure that they have either have the document in advance or they know where to get it very quickly. And then I'll just mention one of the other documents that we always put and lump together in the mm-hmm. required documents, and where should it be? The living will,
right.
health or healthcare proxy.
Mm-hmm.
That document is appointing somebody, could be multiple people, but usually one person who could step in and make life and death decisions.
Right.
The hospitals may actually require you to write one and
okay.
fill one out
right.
if you're going in for a surgery, even to appoint a spouse,
mm-hmm.
Even though a spouse obviously would be somebody who should be able to make those decisions. But they would probably require you to fill one out, just a form. You want that person to actually have that form, and,
right.
and because and you should really discuss it with them. It's a funny legal form. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's a legal form, but the goal of the form is that the understanding usually these forms is that you've actually discussed what your wishes are.
Right.
Should you need again whether to continue life support, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the documents generally assume that the person you've appointed knows your wishes and. Obviously, sometimes religious, you may want to put, check with clergy.
Right.
And there may be some religious issues here, and that may be important to be written there, and also
and
for the appointee yeah. to know it. So that's that document, again, you can keep it in your house, but I would say that one, the appointee should probably have a copy of it.
Right. Okay, thank you, Jonathan. So actually, talking about the living will is making me think of living trust. And that this is, you know, another whole area in terms of all this estate planning that we'd love to explore a little bit. So could you explain, in essence, what is a living trust? And does it take the place of a will? Is that something
well,
that is recommended?
Well, depends on who you're asking whether it's recommended or not.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously people who promote these as required document. Now, it's not just a document. I'll just define what a living trust is. It is a revocable
mm-hmm.
trust, which, if you create one, you retitle assets. If you do exactly what the promoters tell you to do, you could put your house, your car, everything in the name of the trust.
Right.
Now, of course, that's not so realistic. So you may not put everything in there, but you put a lot of things in there. And then while you're alive, it's you are your own trustee.
Mm-hmm.
You're managing your own assets. You're writing checks out of the, the checks of the John Smith living trust account or
mm-hmm.
whatever, something like that. And you're managing your assets. Upon your passing, the assets that are in the name of the trust are now governed by the trust itself.
Okay.
Now, what are some of the advantages of
what? What does that mean, actually?
Well, that means that anything, just like I mentioned that. Insurance policies are not governed by the will. Well, anything in a trust is not governed by the will. So there are some advantages to doing this. It was touted as a way to avoid high costs of probate,
okay.
but I just mentioned already that chances are there will still be things in your name as an individual,
right.
and not everything will be in your living trust. So if there's still anything left in your name that needs to change title, there will be a probate.
What would be an example of something like that?
cars.
Right. You know, artwork.
Artwork's an unusual example. But if you had valuables in the house,
mm-hmm.
You would have to gather them up, and the probate court might supervise that. So you may have created added layers of complexity where you have your family has to go through a probate process, and you have somebody managing the trust. I like to tell people that a living trust is a will substitute.
Okay.
It sort of replaces the will,
mm-hmm.
A little more sophisticated way of addressing how you're going to distribute your assets. It's also a more sophisticated version of a power of attorney, meaning to say that I mentioned something, if you become disabled,
right.
Your power of attorney kicks in. Well, the same thing for a living trust. A new trustee steps in and can manage your assets. So it's a little smoother because now the new person you appointed to step in your place, should you something happen to you and not able to make decisions, is just now the trustee of this. But basically, the trustee of your living trust or the power of attorney are basically have the same powers.
So is that, you had mentioned earlier, you were giving an example, and you mentioned a supplemental needs trust.
So supplemental needs trust is a particular type of trust that you might create for somebody who is on Social Security disability benefits.
Okay.
Now, if you leave them directly money, then they'll have to just give it to the government one way or another. It'll sort of disqualify them from Social Security. So they created an option where you could put the funds in a special trust, supplemental needs trust, and that some caseworker or somebody involved with the individual who's supposed to be the beneficiary of this can tap into those funds for supplemental needs.
I see.
So while they may be in a group home, something like that, then these funds are used for that purpose. And upon the passing of the beneficiary, the funds pay back the government.
Mm-hmm.
And so your living trust, one of the reasons why people would do a living trust is the trust itself can create other trusts.
Right. Okay.
So in the living trust itself, it will say, "Please create this supplemental needs trust for this particular child." Now, I'm going to tell everyone the truth is that your will can do the exact same thing.
Okay.
And I'm not saying living trusts are a scam. They can be very useful.
Mm-hmm.
And a living trust can take your estate planning to another level. And I really would say is that if you go back to your attorney, if this is something your attorney recommends, let the attorney make the case why a living trust may work better for you. There's no extra tax savings. The savings on probate court is minimal. You know, there's not a huge savings there, so it's not a real reason to do a living trust. And you can take care of your potential disability needs with the power of attorney.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm actually favorable towards living trust because I like the fact that it's somebody who's taking their planning in a very serious manner, and people revisit their living trusts much more often than their wills. So I don't think it's a necessarily bad thing. I just think that people should know that you're getting a little more costs. A will may cost $500.
Are there particular protections that the living trust provides in terms of assets?
Well, the protections of a living trust, the main one is privacy.
Okay.
So if you don't like the idea that somebody can go down to the court and look at your will that's been probated, that is a real feature that people are like. In terms of protections, I actually sense that a will going through probate has more protections because the court, you have to report back to the court how you've fulfilled what the will says.
Okay.
And it's not that everyone's required to do what's called an accounting, because it's sometimes
right.
called an informal accounting.
Right, right.
You don't want to require, if you don't have a large estate, you don't want to require a formal accounting. But there has to be some sort of accounting.
Mm-hmm.
So you have some safety that there's some court supervision to make sure your wishes are fulfilled. The living trust has the trustee, hopefully will fulfill your wishes,
okay.
But it's not as clear. Not as clear to me because there's no court supervision.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, for tax purposes, everything's included, whether it's in a living trust or in your covered by your will,
mm-hmm.
all or even just other accounts, all have to be added up. And obviously, by the way, estate taxes, we haven't focused on it. State taxes, federal state taxes, only apply for individuals with $5 or more million, each individual, husband and wife,
mm-hmm.
double that, upon their passing. So let's assume most people in that bracket are already talking to their attorneys
mm-hmm, right.
and wondering, you know, what they need to do. So the typical 99% of America, that's not an issue. But again, there's no big advantages there. You know, there's one point I want to make about a living trust, and this is just, I think, maybe getting towards the question-answer period anyway.
Right.
The whole goal of all of this is to make sure your wishes are fulfilled, and you want to, you know, and I hate to say this, but quite often individuals' wishes are not fulfilled. Besides, people don't do a will.
Right.
The people who are handling your estate, I mentioned already, that I wonder... we have no hard data on this, but there is a certain amount of wills will not get probated because it's not in the interest of the family who
mm-hmm.
picked up the will. And I've been in meetings where we've offered to the family, do you want us to probate this will or not? And not for avoiding the wishes of the
right.
Of the person who passed away, but just for practical reasons. We just explain
mm-hmm.
the differences. But I suspect if you really want to make sure that your wishes are fulfilled and that you've got a trustee who you know will carry out your wishes, or executor trustee, I actually think that a living trust may be, if this is an issue because you're worried that family might fight, and unfortunately that happens, and I think it's an important issue, and I think that's something to discuss with your lawyer.
Right.
And lawyers will... This is if it's somebody does estates, wills, and trusts. A living trust is something they do regularly, and each lawyer will have their opinion.
Right.
But if that's a concern of yours, that you know, make sure that they will fulfill your wishes, and that's
mm-hmm.
really the whole goal of the whole plan of starting mm-hmm. the conversation. The living trust may actually be a helpful item because the assets are already in the name of a living trust, and the trustee is already appointed,
right.
and that person at that point. They may not, doesn't mean they're going to distribute the assets right away to
right.
beneficiaries because you have to wait whether it's a will or it's a living trust, you've got to wait, the estate has to wait until a period of your creditors have a shot at making claims against the estate.
Right.
So that's going to apply whether it's a will or a living trust. But in any case, it'll be a little bit more easy for that trustee who you've entrusted with this power to go ahead and distribute assets,
mm-hmm.
and they'll be less accountable to the court. Again, that's for better or for worse.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Jonathan. thank you for this robust discussion. This has been great. I think you know, we've gone into touched upon a lot of important things here. And I think, you know, the thing that I'm taking away is just really the importance of planning and the great opportunity that one has with the planning to, you know, get one's affairs in order and, you know, to be able to make sure that, you know, to help the family at the time of passing and to make sure that your wishes are fulfilled and your wishes, you know, you have this real opportunity here to, you know, make an impact. And to continue your legacy and to really, you know, do some wonderful things at this pivotal point, you know, in your life. So so I think at this time it would be great, Aaron, our moderator, if you could please let our listeners know what they can do to ask questions.
Certainly. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and 1 on your touchtone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, it is star then 1 to ask a question. We'll pause briefly to allow questions to queue.
Okay, so maybe while those questions are queuing, Jonathan, I'll go ahead and I have a couple of questions that were sent in advance, maybe I'll just... throw one of these out. Okay, so I do not have many assets. I have life insurance, I have retirement. Those I've already set up as designated beneficiary for. And beyond that, I don't own a home. I have some debt. So I don't really have a lot of assets. What is the benefit of me having a will in such a scenario?
Well, I mean, I guess in theory there could be somebody who's done, who's really distributed everything with beneficiary designations and different titling of assets. Still a good idea to have a will, because there may be things you didn't anticipate. There may be things you don't realize.
Mm-hmm.
Quite often, smaller estates, there's very little to be done. You know,
mm-hmm.
And I've been, as a lawyer, I've been called upon to, hey, we need to, you know, there's a couple assets still in the name of this person. We need to go ahead and implement some open estate in the state, in
right.
probate court, so we can get these assets changed. I guess in cars is a
mm-hmm.
typical
right.
challenge, things like that. So a will doesn't mm-hmm. cost that much money. And it could, since if you've done all that planning in advance, that's great, and you could have done most of your planning through designations like that, but still there's a fallback.
Right.
Anything that doesn't is not covered, or something falls through with that, with all your beneficiary designations, you'll still want a will to cover it. I mean, like, there are circumstances, you know, if there's an individual and they have there's no spouse and there's only, let's say, there's children, well, you know, the law is generally going to be that the children would just divide equally, and that's a case where a will may not even be needed.
Right.
But I'd err on the side of caution and to at least have a simple will done. I can't, as a lawyer, I would be foolish to tell people to go out and use LegalZoom or Nolo, which is another company that offers these do-it-yourself wills. But, you know, that could be a case where
right.
a do-it-yourself will might make sense if you, you know, but I think in the end of the day, I don't think you may not save so much money.
Yeah.
So I would.
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, being directing the Office of Planned Giving here, I see all the bequest gifts that come in. So I, you know, am privy to seeing people's estates and their wills and the size of their estates. And we've received through a bequest many gifts that are, you know, relatively would be considered, you know, let's say a $500 gift or something that is named in a bequest. And, you know, that might seem like, well, it was only $500. But, I mean, you know, and did that need to be named in a will? But first of all, I mean, from our perspective, no gift is too small. We're grateful for every gift. Every gift has an impact. And, you know, where would that money have gone otherwise? I mean, this person was able to really make a statement with that gift. In you know, in their legacy planning, like, this was important to them, that they make that last, you know, they had $500. It wasn't $500,000, but that was important to them. And so, you know, so from our perspective, you know, it's a great opportunity, and it would have been a missed opportunity for that person, and obviously certainly for us.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure you've seen cases like that as well.
Oh, for sure,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Aaron, do we have questions queued up? Can we go ahead to questions from our listeners?
At this time, we do not have any phone questions, but as a reminder to our phone listeners, it is star then one to ask a question today.
Okay. Well, great. So I guess I'll just go ahead with another question. You know, one thing as well that I have here that was given to me is, in terms of the trust, does having property in a trust speed up the distribution of assets once I pass?
Yes, so the answer is not necessarily. It does, at least initially. Again, I think I mentioned already that whether the will, when the will is being probated, there's a certain mandatory time period before you can make distributions,
okay.
because you want to be able to allow creditors to file claims. I think it's usually, it could be 90 days, depending on the state you're
mm-hmm.
in. One of the executor will have to publish that the person has passed away,
mm-hmm.
and then they'll have to file claims. That does not exist for a living trust, assets are in a trust, but a trustee would be smart to wait a little bit, make sure that there's no claims coming in.
Mm-hmm.
So there's going to be a little delay there. But once a certain period has been satisfied, I believe that the trust would have a little more ease
okay.
in distributing the assets. But I don't think it's a huge difference in that you're going to probably wait 9 months to a year to start really distributing large amounts. But of course, depending on the family circumstances, there may be some smaller distributions. I mean, most lawyers and accountants would say just wait a little bit because we want to make sure before we distribute all the funds, we may have other costs that we have to address before that. We don't want to have to call the money back.
Right.
And so maybe a little bit of advantage there, but that's not a that reason itself wouldn't be a reason to create a living trust. Would not be. It might be a little nicer, but my sense is that most of the time lawyers are helping the family in either side, either case. So lawyers helping with the administration of the estate or the living trust, and they're probably going to tell you to wait just as long. And so in that sense, a living trust is just like a will.
Oh, okay. Okay, that makes sense. So, okay. Well, Aaron, if there are no other questions, I think we can go ahead and wrap up now.
And there are no phone questions at this time.
Okay. So then I'd like to just take the opportunity to thank all our guests, all our listeners, for being with us today. We hope this was a fruitful time for you. Hope that it answered many questions that you have had. I hope that it shed some light on this important topic for you. And feel free to reach out to me at any time. You have my contact information on the information that was sent to you, but I will send you some follow-up materials as well, along with a worksheet for getting started with planning your estate. So I look forward to keeping in touch with you that way. And we'll be doing these calls, some more of these calls going forward. So there'll be another opportunity to participate in, on different topics, but we hope you'll join us for those. Thank you, Jonathan. Any final?
I hope we were able to communicate clearly some of the basic ideas here and hopefully give you some things to think about and some ideas to start working on.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
This does conclude today's Plan Giving program brought to you by the Dominican Foundation and the Rosary Shrine of St. Jude. Thank you for your participation.